Welcome to the Politics of Everything. I'm Amber Danes, your host and podcast producer. This is a half hour of power, a podcast dropping every week where I unpack the politics of everything, from money to motherhood, nutrition to narcissism, startups to secularism, the environment, quality, and much, much more. Our guests are seasoned in the field or topic of their choice, even if you've not heard of them yet. This is a non-partisan show. So while I love exploring varied views and get a buzz from a healthy debate of ideas, this is not a purely blue, white, green program. Please subscribe, tune in, and enjoy the politics of everything. Many people enjoy, for example, multiplayer games and virtual worlds, and learning how to stay safe online is a big deal. It could be anything from gaming to gambling. And of course, screen time has become part of BAU in work and in our social lives. Smartphones are life, as my teen says. And one review I read comparing children's screen time before and during the COVID-19 pandemic shows children's screen time spiked by a whopping 52% between 2020 and 2022, which doesn't really surprise me, having lived through the homeschooling period. My guest today, Jocelyn Brewer, is a Sydney-based psychologist with a special interest in the psychology of technology and staying human in a digitally saturated world. Jocelyn has previously been a high school social sciences teacher and school counsellor, working across New South Wales public schools between 2003 and 2021. Her psychology thesis explored the impacts of increasing access to internet-enabled laptops on a cohort of grade 10 boys and the emerging area of problematic internet use. PIU apparently is the short version of that, colloquially known as internet addiction. She created Digital Nutrition in 2013 as a positive framework for addressing digital well-being issues and our love-hate relationship with technology, and in 2021 completed a master's in cyber psychology at Sydney Uni. In addition to her small psychology practice where she works with adolescents and adults, Jocelyn is a sought-after speaker, educator, and media commentator on issues relating to cyber psychology, digital well-being, and mental health, and I warmly welcome her to the Politics of Everything.
Hey, Amber. Thank you for having me.
Podcasting remotely can be challenging, but it doesn't have to be. Since day one of the Politics of Everything, I have relied on Zencaster's all-in-one solution to make the process quick and painless, the way it should be for those of us who just love great content and want to get our ideas out into the world. If you know me, I'm obsessed with quality in terms of my guests, my sound, and everything about my show has to be great the first time. I'm time poor. It's so easy to use Zencaster. I'm not tech savvy and you don't need to be either. There's nothing to download. Just click on the link and off we go. Zencaster is all about making your podcasting experience easy, and with everything from local recording to automate post-productions now in their toolkit, you don't have to leave your browser to get that episode done, and done fast. I have a special offer for you, and I hopefully you can experience what I have with Zencaster. Go to zencaster.com/pricing and use my VIP code, the Politics of Everything, all lowercase and one word, to get 30% off your first 3 months of Zencaster Professional. How good is that? I want you to have the same easy experiences I do for all my podcasting and content needs. It's time to share your story. This is a big topic, and I suppose I'd love to find out before we get into it what you thought you'd do as a kid. Did you always think that you would be like in some sort of teaching role, or did you sort of think something else would be your bag, if you like?
Yeah, look, I wanted to be a vet. I spent year 10 and 11 work experience at the zoo. I was at the CSIRO doing stuff with animals. And then I worked out I needed 97 as an ATAR, or back then a TER, and I went, oh, I'm not that smart. And probably what I thought was, I'm actually not interested in working that hard.
Yeah. Having said, I wouldn't say you're not smart. There's a few creds there that tell me that you are.
Yeah. But, I mean, you know, interesting as a 16-year-old, like I didn't think that I could do that. And I really gave up on myself in the moment. I share this story quite a lot with the young people that I work with. Yeah. And then I point to the 5 degrees that are on the wall in my office and say, you know, the ATAR really is just a number.
Totally.
The internet didn't really exist. When I did my HSC in 1995, there was one computer in our library that really didn't, like, it went on to the internet, but no one was there yet. So it was a bunch of nerds putting, you know, chat posts up.
Oh, I know. I did my first degree at University of Technology in the 90s. And yeah, like the information superhighway was such a novel concept that none of us really got it. Like we just all sat there. I was doing journalism and I was like, what is this thing? It was so foreign to us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then by the time, you know, I was teaching, I was also on MySpace and I was getting my first iPod, which I remember I was at Sydney Boys High and I gave it to the school captain at the time and he took it home and put all of his torrented music onto my iPod and I, you know, like this was
such Did you love
exciting.
It?
Yes. and he's an incredible human too, as most of the students I taught at that time were. But, yeah, like this was just such a fascinating time. And it actually was the principal at Sydney Boys High, Dr. Kim Jagger, who when I was retraining to be a school counsellor and I had to do a research project, said, oh, I don't know what I'm going to research. What do we need to look at, Kim? And he said, you got to work out what's going on with boys and games because a lot of the students at high still are really having trouble pulling themselves out of some of their online spaces because they meet their psychological needs so well. So,
yeah. Yep. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
I blame Dr. Jagger. He's like the
patron. Oh, look, it's good to join the dots. And obviously you found the thing that you're not just good at but you're passionate about as well. Mm-hmm. This is such a loaded question probably and there's probably no real metrics because I feel like it's an age thing as well and generation thing. But how much screen time is considered generally okay? It's probably like sleep. Some people need 5 hours, some people need eight. Mm-hmm. Is it kind of staged by age and developmental level? And what's reasonable for both us as adults and also our kids? Because let's face it, everyone's kind of addicted to that little computer in our handbags. Mm-hmm. Yeah, what's your thoughts on this?
Yeah, well, I've spent probably the last 10 years arguing that how much screen time is enough screen time or too much is actually the completely wrong question. So while we all have 24 hours in the day, and yes, you know, some celebrities and some, you know, more affluent people have more access to different resources to do more or different things with that time, we don't want to get too caught up with how many minutes because it's really about the content that we're consuming. Mm-hmm. I would argue...
That's interesting.
Yeah, I would argue that actually, you know, any minutes of really abhorrent, you know, pornographic, really gross material is too many minutes. But if your young person in the middle of a pandemic is using technology to learn, to connect, to try and have some fun in a really kind of dark time, then can we, you know, limit that? How do we quantify that? So the content and the context is really the better question to ask about our screen-based media use, which is the more fancy word for what we kind of lump in as screen time. That's become the kind of catch-all for how we use screens. But the time factor, it's kind of like counting calories without actually looking at the virtual vitamins. So if we just said, how many calories did you eat today? And we didn't say, well, how much of that was protein? How much of that was green veggies? How much of that was, you know, good carbs? Then we'd actually be missing the point. Yeah. So, you know, and again, there's a really great question there. Why don't adults have screen time limits? Because the limits that are put in place, and we still have them around, they're 2 hours a day for kids between 5 and 17, have been virtually impossible for probably 10 years at this point.
And I think it's a lot about the fact of how much we rely on the technology now. Mm-hmm. Like it's not something where even at my kids' school, you know, and I've got a child in primary school, a child in high school, they're the one independent school. And I do find it's like that everything is on the iPad. They don't barely learn to like the pen and paper is not a thing, if you know what I mean.
And so it's really hard. It needs to be a thing, yeah, because at the moment the HSC in New South Wales is handwritten still. We haven't moved and made a jump onto typing up your legal studies essay for right.
Yeah, there is that divide, of course. So, and look, you know, it's a really hard one, I suppose, also because a lot of people, kids get to an age where they're not necessarily telling you how much time they're online as well.
Well, no, and as humans, we're really crap at estimating the amount of time we do things for. And this is why some of the screen time research that we see is actually really bad research because it asks the young person, how many hours did you do this thing for? And I don't know about you, but I'm really bad at estimating how long I spent, you know, writing a newsletter
absolutely.
Or whatever.
Like, unless it's like a time thing, like a spin class where I know it's 45 minutes. Right. And time is elastic.
Exactly, right? The instructor's in charge of telling you when it's 45 minutes. Me as the therapist, I have clocks all around my room so I can keep track of when that session needs to wind up. So I guess the thing about time online is really about what it's displacing. So I see our screen use really needs to sit in the gaps of what's left over when we've slept well, we've done enough exercise, we've completed the responsibilities that are aligned to our family's values. Now, that in my household, that's put your pajamas under your pillow, feed the rabbit, and make sure your shoes aren't, you know, left out for me to fall over. So when, you know, like, let's face it, that takes about 3 minutes.
Particularly if you're going to be motivated with a reward, like a dopamine fix from a screen, you know what I mean? Like that sort of, okay, if I do all these things really quickly, then I get to the thing I really want to do.
Absolutely. And that's kind of how the world works, right? You've got to go to work and do the work in order then for you to be able to get the next reward. So, yeah, look, it's about displacement. I think if we look at that 24 hours that we have, are we sleeping well? Are we moving our bodies enough? And are we doing enough face-to-face connection? Are we doing those extracurricular activities? Are we participating in a way that doesn't create this reliance and this go-to on screens? And again, considering that screens and screen time is a million different things, it's not one thing.
Exactly. It's not the one device. And that could include anything from, I guess, watching TV to being on your laptop to, I don't know, probably using your GPS in a way.
Yeah, but it's also about who you follow, right? So for me, I've done a big clean out of who I follow recently, and I was following two guys who whippersnipper lawns. And I'm like, I don't.
Was that a pandemic thing? Like, that just, it's like watching paint dry, surely.
Yeah. It's like, have you seen the ones where like people clean really, really dirty rugs and they get these massive brushes? Like, it's kind of like that, the stuff that you listen to, the whispering stuff that you listen to go to sleep.
Yeah, whoosh, whoosh, like the ocean, the seashell in your ear from the 1980s on a tape, which, was very, very big at one point. Look, there's been a recent study by the eSafety Commissioner in Australia saying carers and parents should actually spend more time online, perhaps playing games with their kids so they know what's going on. Is this something that you would advocate for, and why? Because I have to admit, I've got two sons. I couldn't think anything worse than sitting there playing Fortnite. Like, I kind of have the door open and I can hear it, but it actually gives me a little bit of, like, you know, PTSD watching it. It's not my thing.
Yeah. So that's exactly why you probably need to play it. And I set playing with your kids online as homework in my workshops, my play shops, with parents, because part of it is really, and you go back to your experience of your own parents not liking the music you're into, or not wanting to watch the TV shows that you wanted to watch, East Street on a Thursday night, for example. So, look, I do encourage this because we need to know what the playgrounds are that they're playing in. It's not like looking at a swing set and saying, okay, I get how that works. There's a lot of factors within these online spaces that parents just do not have a clue about, and that becomes a bit of a danger point, to be honest. It also is about us being able to get into a space. So let's say it's not Fortnite. Let's say we find a game that neither you nor your kids have played before, and that you set it up as something you do as a family, that they can see you learning, that can see you being crap at something and then not giving up.
Yeah.
So, you know, again, I sort of jokingly say to parents, a parent who is too busy to play a video game with their kid for 20 minutes needs to play that video game for an hour. Because what you're missing with connection to your kids, the conversation, really, if you're not pretending to be interested, at least in
Fortnite, would be pretending. It would totally be pretending.
You would have to, right? If you're not pretending to be interested in what's happening in Fortnite, they are not going to come to you with what's happening in real life when the proverbial's hitting the fan.
Yeah.
Because you're not interested in the little stuff, so why would they tell you the big stuff?
Which is funny because we trivialize gaming in a way, you know, that's sort of not important, or it's just something fun they do, and it's not like doing a, you know, an activity as a family, like going to the zoo or bungee jumping, you know. But I guess as generations have moved into what they define as fun and recreation, that's kind of part of it, right? Screen time is core to that as well.
So we have to be really careful of invalidating young people's interests, and we do that all the time, generation after generation, and then we wonder why they won't come and talk to us, because we've literally told them that we think the stuff that they do is crap.
Yeah. Is there any way we can make screen time as regularly appealing as other activities you know, in terms of like saying, oh, well, that's probably the time question, really. It's like, oh, an hour of exercise, an hour of screen time. That doesn't sometimes work. And I know during the pandemic when, you know, my kids were home all the time, they'd done their schoolwork by 11. I don't know what quality level, but that's, you know, neither here nor there. And then there's just be online chatting to friends because it was social, and then they'd be gaming for like hours and hours. You'd say you've been on for 2 hours and they'd be like, I've been on 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So how do we actually make sure that, you know, these activities that we're doing online are enjoyable, but they're also balanced time-wise? I mean, it feels like it's a little bit of a bank thing where you kind of have to have some other activities. You can't just do 5 minutes of exercise and come back. Because, you know, we could do the walk. I mean, we walk in our local mm-hmm. community, but they'd be rushing to get back to actually go back on the screen. And it's like, but you've been on that thing for hours and this is like 15 minutes.
Yeah.
It's probably a hard one, I think, to balance out.
Well, again, it's actually sitting with the human need to have hedonic experiences, right? In a game of would you rather eat some broccoli or eat some, you know, candy, most people are going to be like, oh, you know, I know broccoli is good for me, but geez, I want the sweet stuff, okay? So what we need to do, I guess, here is be able to set up young people to understand and for ourselves to understand why limiting some aspects of online activities are really, really important. It's impossible, I would say, at this point in human history to make doing your homework as interesting as playing a video game or doing connecting with your friends online or, you know, whatever the things, you know, talking to your friends in a Discord server. I think it's about, as you say, the balance. I don't necessarily love the word balance. It's more about the sense of blending. Have I today slept enough, moved my body enough, done the things I need, and then, as I was saying before, you know, what's left over then might go into those gaps. Mm. It's also then about looking at the psychological needs that that's meeting. So generally online spaces are really good at meeting our need for motivation and these three psychological needs around competence, so being good at something. Kids are bloody good at participating in online spaces, and games are designed to help them feel really good, like they're about to level up.
Oh, there's lots of rewards and milestones mm-hmm. and it's not as hard as probably real life sometimes.
That's right. Yeah. You literally see your score increasing. You don't see that in class when you're doing a maths worksheet.
Yeah.
And we have the sense of control. You get to choose who you are, what you play, how you play, what strategies you use. And then you get that sense of connection. So these three C's, which in self-determination theory are these psychological needs, are incredibly powerful and are incredibly fostered in online spaces in a way that a maths class, doing your homework, you know, cleaning up after the rabbit or, you know, jumping on the trampoline even aren't necessarily going to, you know, fire up a kid's brain. But when you kind of, as a parent, set the rules and you say, well, when you've had this and when you've had that, that opens up for this amount of time and we're going to do these kind of activities and you get to curate that, that's where you kind of shape what I call the digital diet. Mm. So, you know.
And is time important? Mm. Like this is what I'm just thinking out loud here. This is not to me.
Because you need to go to bed by a certain time.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. And also not waking up and being the first thing you do. I'm really big mm-hmm. on that. Like,
yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I teach in my courses about how not to book in the day with technology. And the first question I ask is, are parents doing that themselves? Mm. In which case it's really hard with a teenager to have bad habits and them not to call us a hypocrite. Now, again, a generation ago, I would have been in a lot of trouble for calling my father out on anything he did. But this generation has a difference sometimes of permissions. And we actually encourage youth voice and student voice in order to actually kind of set some of those rules. And that's part of my tech use agreement course where we actually sit down as a family and say, what's working around technology? What's not working? What do we love doing? Where does it get a bit sticky and slippery? And how do we actually notice and know when it's tipping over too much? Because often we're not trained to just notice the cues. And you know, you might notice yourself when you
I know it myself. I've just got to shut everything down and walk away. I get agitated. I actually get like, it's almost like restless leg syndrome or something in my whole body. Like I'm so agitated by being in front of a screen, I just can't do it.
It's an actual thing. It's cognitive overload. So we have cognitive load theory and we know, and every teacher who comes through teaching college basically learns about how much information you can pack into a brain at different levels over the course of, you know, a 45-minute lesson. And we literally are, you know, ancient creatures. Our brain has not been really updated for 30 to 40,000 years, yet we are consuming godlike technology and huge amounts of information. So we're just expecting too much out of a really old operating system, like, you know, playing the new version of Fortnite on a Commodore 64.
There's a whole generation going, what is she talking about? But I know what you're talking about. Yeah. So there you go. That's going to definitely age me. Do you find in your psychology work that adults who don't rely on devices to dictate their day, to stay connected, to communicate, are better off mentally or otherwise than, say, younger generations where it's almost the digital native thing where there's no way that they would do it any other way? It's all on messages or like Snapchat, or like they don't really even pick up the phone. Like the phone's not for phone calls. It's just an interesting thing. Mm-hmm. So do you find that it's is it better or is it more centered? Are you like, I don't know. It's a hard one because I feel like part of it's like we need to move with the times as well.
Yeah, we don't have the research on that. So I really couldn't say. I think, you know, adults, you know, older millennials, I think of myself as an elder millennial, we are a bit in the sandwich where we're using, you know, technologies like Facebook, which turned 20 this month.
I'm Gen X, so I feel even older than you.
Well, you know, and I actually technically I'm Gen X, but I like to think of myself as an elder. Oh,
do you feel cooler? I think I'm pretty like, yeah, it's interesting. I kind of, the generational thing is weird, but I do feel it. I do know in my business with younger staff, there's just things which I'm not even that interested in having every app and all things. You know, but I just need the things I need to know.
That's the nature of generational change, right? It's not necessarily the technology. Well, it is the technology because in every generation there's technological change. In this case, it's just digital technologies and Web 2.0. Those are kind of Gen whatever they are now, right? Your younger staff are going to have
Gen Z is my youngest staff member, so they're in their early 20s.
Right? They're going to have the same response to the metaverse. And Douglas Adams sort of talks about the idea that any technology that's created after you're 35 is just against the natural order of things.
Oh, my goodness, it's so true. Right? Why is that?
Yeah. And, well, it's because we're
saving Even though away. We're living longer, though, too. Like, there's part of me that goes, but that feels like a really ancient way to look at your life, you know what I mean? Because our life expectancy is longer and we're going to be...
Our life expectancy is longer, but the generation that's born today is the first generation in several to have a lower life expectancy than us.
Which is a bit frightening.
They're more sedentary. They eat more crap food.
Oh, yeah, processed food.
Unless we get our shit together with managing vapes and some of the other lifestyle issues, we've got generations of people who are not going to have the life expectancy that you and I and even my grandmother who, you know, all my grandmothers lived into, they're well into.
Even though they survived world wars and had dripping on their potatoes and all the things that we know.
Exactly, right?
Yeah. So interesting.
I think we have to look holistically at how society and our cultures have changed, not the fact that, you know, a person who made a social media platform who's now a trillionaire has shaped our lives. That is one piece. A complex puzzle.
It's very
easy to lay blame on Mark Zuckerberg or to the things that he's created.
Or even the smartphone. I remember, you know, the late Steve Jobs, he didn't want his kids having them because he knew the iPhone was so addictive. There was a whole thing about
That's the kind of narrative and the mythology that you hear about that. And we hear,
I'm sure they all had them. They probably had everything, like, you know, a pony and everything.
Yeah, exactly, right? So Silicon Valley executives, I don't let my kids have too much screen time. No, because you have a nanny to actually support your kids, go to 17 different
activities. Yeah, and do 18 craft activities, which, you know, make my skin crawl.
It comes back to, like, we're talking about privilege. Massive digital divides and privilege and different resources that we have to, you know, chop up the 24 hours that we all get in the day.
Mm.
So some of those narratives do drive me a bit crazy because I think we need a much more critical lens over some of those things, over some of the things that we see in memes on online spaces, you know, that we're scrolling through, especially as we head into an election year in possibly Australia. We might have a federal election in 2024, but certainly the US in November.
Absolutely.
We need to get much better at being able to spot not just misinformation, but disinformation and malinformation, and being really, really media literate And these are skills no one has learnt, right? So again, I don't like the idea of digital native. They're digital orphans. They're growing up without a generation above them to guide them through what to
It's
do.
True. And look, I, you know, having been a former news journalist and having, you know, I still a very keen interest in what is called traditional media, which has its own biases. But I always say to people, like, people think they're journalists now. They're not. Like, just having a smartphone and a thought is not the same as having to have verified information. You could be sued. Like, this is how journalists operate. We have a code of ethics, you know, all those things. But everyone sort of blurs those lines, and like, influencers are not the same as journalists. You know, I try and tell that to my kids as well. And they're like, oh, this person who's famous is speaking truth. It's like, well,
And it's a really big issue that, you know, I am building a course this year called The Intentional Influencer. I might even change it to The Ethical Influencer, because these people end up with incredible power. They generally want to do good, but they haven't been trained in it, right? And so when you know better, you do better. And while, you know, we could have a whole podcast about, you know, journalistic standards and ethics within that and who owns our media in Australia and things, that's all part of what ends up being in this kind of screen time lump, because it's what we're consuming. It's not the phone, it's not the platform, it's the pieces of information that are going into our brain that we're trying to quickly make sense out of and decode when we're doing that at scale. So, you know, you like this statistic that this was a decade ago, we were consuming the equivalent of 174 newspapers worth of information in a day.
Oh my goodness.
Okay. Now, as I said before, our brains are not designed for that. Our brains are designed to look at a horizon, to check for threat on that horizon, and to hunt and gather for things close to our feet. We are living lives that are absolutely not congruent with what our operating system is. So we've got to be really careful, I think, at this point.
It's a tipping point, I reckon. Yeah, it's coming. Absolutely. It's here probably already. Mm-hmm. Like, even things like defollowing people is a good thing, because it's just too much.
That mute button. I exercised the mute button for 30 days in a mother's group in January, and I had a really great January. I was thinking, why do I feel
just get rid of that, I reckon. If you don't miss it, it's like when you clean out your wardrobe, you know, and you go, oh, but I really loved that dress 5 years ago. It's like, when it's gone, you never think about it again, I promise you.
Exactly.
This will be an interesting question for you, and it is a question I ask all my guests this year, is your number one business tool or hack, not the smartphone, and how it's helping you in business or life.
Yeah, so there are no hacks in life. There are only, you know, habits. I think hack leads us to the idea that there's a silver bullet. Mm-hmm. So again, one of the words I don't really love is hack, because it leads us to that kind of, oh, there's a quick fix.
Shortcut. Yeah.
I would say nothing worth doing is going to like happen quickly. Sure, there's little things that you can tweak, but sleep is really the number one.
Oh, there you go. That's a novel answer. I've had like everything other than that been said to me so far. So
getting your 8 hours for me at 7.5, having, you know, the research basically says get up at the same time every day, regardless of.
Oh, I do that. But that's also a getting older thing. I can't sleep in. Yeah. I cannot.
Yeah. So that's your neurobiology, right? As we age, when we go through menopause, our hormones change, and our suprachiasmatic nucleus, which is the little clock in our head, will then alter based on those sleep needs. So being able to listen to your sleep needs and really honor that is the biggest kind of lifestyle kind of, I don't know.
Tool. Habit. It's great. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Your biggest life lesson to date, and why?
Oh, this is an interesting one. When I was 19, I was going from one party to a party at Manning Bar in Sydney Uni, and I got mugged. I was 29.
Oh, that's horrendous.
Yeah, I got mugged by three teenage girls.
Wow.
Literally hit over the head. It was, pretty bad. But what it taught me was, I was on the path to becoming a school counsellor, and I was maybe about to fail psychology and not get the credit average that I needed. And I wasn't really sure. I was kind of thinking about giving up. And these girls kind of attacking me was the hit over the head I needed to pick up my socks, get my psych degree, and become a school counselor to have impact on young people who thought that was a good idea and probably just didn't have anything better to do on a Saturday night than rob me.
But
at the time, my Nokia flip phone, which I did get back, there's even a video of me and my friend in the Newtown police station talking, like filmed in the most great video ever, going, we're sitting here, I've got a black eye, I've lost my bag.
Oh dear.
Yeah, so like turning a situation like that, which I grew up in the western suburbs of Sydney, so I wasn't always on the night rider home. I never had an you know, a,
incident.
An incident until I was 29 and it was young people and it was my wake-up call to continuing to work with young people.
And how did you define your version of success?
By not setting an alarm. I don't have an alarm. My kids are my alarm.
Talking about sleep, come on. Or do you just wake up?
I kind of just wake up. I usually wake up because she's waking me up.
Fair enough.
But, I mean, my success to me is being able to design my life to the degree that I don't have to wake up by a certain time, get my kid out the door or whatever. I mean, we've only ever been late to school once in 2 years. So, yeah, there's a natural rhythm to our family, but I'm not the sort of person who wakes up at 5 o'clock and, you know, meditates on the sunrise and has some kind of miracle interaction with the universe first thing. Yeah.
There's still time.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not, you know, like people who that works for, that's great. I am not one of those people. So for me, it's just that ability to have a slow life. It's not about how much can I cram in or, I don't know, some of the other metrics of success.
Checklists and stuff.
Yeah. Women in business and women entrepreneurs often I find, and part of what I tune out from in my own social media feeds is that kind of real girl bossy stuff and hustle culture.
I think that's done. I think we're done with that.
Oh, I don't know. I see it popping up in other
See, I'm just muted it all and defollowed. So, you know, I feel like that's so 10 years ago. And I think the world, particularly after the pandemic, changed its way of operating.
I think it shape shifts a lot that people know that it needs to change, but it pops up in these other kind of icky ways that I see and I interpret. Yeah, I mean,
if it's not for you, yeah, I reckon just keep walking.
Yeah,
that's what I always say to my kids as well. Yeah. A final message for us today on the politics of screen time.
We need to really be conscious consumers. We need to switch on the most complex technology on the planet, which is under our skull, and remember that we have agency over how we spend our time, that how we spend our time, you know, it's a non-renewable resource. You only get one go at today. Yes, you have tomorrow and blah, blah, blah. But your agency really is what's going to help you navigate towards those metrics of success you have. So, yeah. Our mental health is far more complex than a smartphone.
Yeah, I agree. And I think this conversation has really shone a light in a few areas where everyone can pay more attention. So thank you so much for your time, Jocelyn. Until next time, do take care. Thanks so much for listening today. If you've enjoyed the politics of everything, I thrive on your feedback. So please add a short review and share the podcast with your network through Apple, Spotify, and all the usual suspects. I'm always on the hunt for new and diverse guests. So if you or someone you know has a fresh idea you're busting to get out there, please email me at amber@amberdanes.com and my crew will get back to you very soon.